because we've been operating at a very high level, and now we're going to really zoom in to a very individual level. So today I'm going to be talking about factors that modify neighbors' willingness to, self-reported willingness to intervene in a domestic violence or intimate partner violence situation in an urban setting, New York City, using concept mapping methodology. And I want to acknowledge a study team that helped me with this work and continues to do so, Mary Justine Todd, Malik Cupid, Sarah Wee, and Michael Oshiro. They were all, with the exception of Malik, students who worked with me at one point, and now they've moved on to bigger and better things. Peggy, I'm going to ask you to tell me every 5 minutes, because, okay. Is that okay? Great. Okay. I don't think I have anything to disclose, but this research was supported actually by a career development award to me from NIDA. So perhaps I read it wrong, but I didn't know if that was a disclosure. I saw some other people disclosing it, so I'll tell you. I included the abstract and the learning objectives just for the PowerPoints, which I uploaded, and I think that they're available to folks. Okay. Yeah. So as background, I really don't need to go through this with you guys, but I will. As we know, intimate partner violence is a very serious social and public health problem. It's associated with multiple adverse health outcomes for women, men, children, families, and communities. We're all here in part because we focus on preventing IPV, and we work at the primary and secondary level, primarily in terms of IPV prevention. And one of my goals is to really be looking at prevention at multiple levels of the social ecology, so not just at the individual level, although I will be talking about that today. I hope, though, you'll see how it connects up higher through the dyadic, family, and community and neighborhood levels. And as we've been hearing already, we've been talking about governmental agencies working at the policy level and coordinated community responses. So my research comes to this very much from a neighborhood or community effects on intimate partner violence approach. And so the theoretical bases from which I work or from that have predominated in terms of this are social disorganization and collective efficacy theories, which I'm going to get to in a moment. But in summary, there have really been mixed empirical findings on the applicability of looking at neighborhood effects on intimate partner violence. And so what I'm really interested in is do the processes of control that have been hypothesized to be at work, according to these perspectives, work, actually work when we're looking at intimate partner violence and intimate partner violence against women, because that is my focus and of my talk today and of my research. And again, obviously, that doesn't mean that there's not intimate partner violence against men. But I also want to know, what do people say about these processes? What actions can we as residents and neighbors actually imagine ourselves taking in these situations? And what modifies our willingness to take action? So again, just as background, in terms of the social control of intimate partner violence, we have the formal social control systems. That's what we've been talking about primarily today. Healthcare, criminal legal systems, healthcare systems, social welfare systems, you know, APS, CPS, all of those. And we also have informal social control. Those are the behaviors of individuals and groups that individuals and groups undertake to maintain group norms of behavior. So we all agree as a general rule that homicide is bad, and we will try to prevent it using multiple approaches. There is not necessarily consensus, though, on intimate partner violence or, for example, child abuse. So, you know, that's one of the reasons that I've been critical of these approaches. But informal social control is basically how we police each other. And this is from that social disorganization collective efficacy theory perspective. So the action component of collective efficacy, which has been operationalized as basically informal social control and the social cohesion of a neighborhood, it are the actions or behaviors that we engage in to control deviance, and it's literally called deviance. So this comes from the Chicago School of Sociology, very old school stuff. And it's been measured in a very traditional way by asking people how likely they would be to intervene or do something if they saw things like children spray painting graffiti. And I can tell you, I live in New York City, that's still, you know, a really big issue. Our neighborhoods are still tagged up, and it's not artistic graffiti. It's, you know, stuff that doesn't help. And it, you know, marks out gang territory and whatnot. Children skipping school and someone being beaten up or threatened. So this is bystander intervention. These are bystander intervention behaviors. So what I have done is I've looked at this very much from this collective efficacy perspective and critiqued its applicability to intimate partner violence against women. But when you drill down into it, somebody actually has to do the intervening, and those are individuals and their bystanders. And so from the bystander intervention perspective, so I've been sort of coming at it from top to bottom. Bystander intervention people have been coming at it, I knew I could do this, from bottom up. And so they conceptualize it as a cognitive and affective decision-making process that is affected by lots of different factors: situational context, norms, outcome expectancies, having an experience as a former victim or witness, similarities with the victim, et cetera. Those all influence the evaluation of the situation and a sense of an obligation to act, and it can also diffuse a sense of responsibility. I'm going to skip this slide, but in prior research, the focus has been on prior victimization and presence of children, and that's what I'm going to be focusing on today. And in our prior research, we've done a concept mapping study already where we assess bystander behaviors, and we found that there's a really wide range of behaviors that people might engage in to prevent intimate partner violence. But there's very little research on what modifies your willingness to engage in some of those behaviors. So our study had three main objectives. We wanted to describe community-generated bystander intervention strategies, and we did this by asking people to respond to the question with very discreet fill-in-the-blanks to this phrase: what is one specific action that a neighbor or group of neighbors could do to prevent a woman from experiencing partner violence? We wanted to examine whether situational characteristics influence participants' self-reported willingness to engage in the strategies, and to explore group differences in that perceived feasibility and effectiveness of the strategies generated. So this is a method that I think it's actually a great method for using in CBPR and using to establish community understandings of focal phenomenon. So our focal question, as I said, was one specific action that a neighbor or group of neighbors could do. And then you get everybody together in these brainstorming sessions, and you ask them to brainstorm responses to that. And these are called statements. And then you review these statements with the group. You get rid of redundant ones. So, you know, people will say the same thing, and they'll say the same thing in different ways. So when they overlap, you get rid of those, or you make them clear. And you want to end up with a parsimonious set of very clear and short statements. The participants then, not typically in the same group because it's actually quite exhausting, you bring them back and you get them to actually take all of these statements and sort them into piles that they feel like are grouped together in some way that makes sense to them. So it's sort of like, these are all statements that has to do with X, these are all statements that have to do with Y, these are all statements that have to do with A and B. You also ask the participants to rate each statement on dimensions of it that you think are important. And in our case, we looked at feasibility and effectiveness. You then push it all into the software program. You come up with these conceptual maps. So concept mapping actually results in a visual depiction of how a group of people understand your focal phenomenon. You can present the results back to the group, and then hopefully you engage in action steps related to it. So in our study, we had eligibility criteria. You had to be 18 years of age or older. You had to be able to read or write in English, and you had to be a resident of the focal neighborhood. We had 41 participants who participated in our groups. We generated over 200 statements. They were reduced to 72. And, of course, the study was reviewed by the IRB. I want to get into the rating procedure a little bit more. So we asked about, and this is sort of the bottom half of our slide, we asked about feasibility for you, and that meant you could or would do the action, feasibility if a child was in the home, feasibility if the couple had a history of IPV, and effectiveness. That's not the right way. So how was history of abuse defined? It was if there was abuse in the home and the couple breaks up and gets back together often, the couple has been together for a very long time, or the woman stays with the man or defends him even though he is abusive to her. Children present was sort of elaborated on by saying there are kids living within the apartment. You know that kids are at least sometimes involved with or witness the abuse. Okay. There was a 5-point Likert scale going from not at all feasible to extremely feasible or effective. Okay, so the participants sorted and rated, and we applied two statistical techniques to create our maps. One is multidimensional scaling, the other is hierarchical cluster analysis. And so what happens is the multidimensional scaling solution is restricted to two dimensions in concept mapping. And yields this XY value, which is then plotted on a map, and then hierarchical cluster analysis takes all the points and sort of agglomeratively clumps them together. And I'm going to walk through it very quickly right now. So basically what you have is an X, okay, actually, so this is, you get the square matrix, and it eventually gives you an n-dimension map. So this is a sort for one participant. And it gives you a binary square similarity matrix. Every single statement is listed on the X and the Y axis, and you get a 0, 1 for whether the participant put those two statements together in a pile. And this is stuff, you know, you don't need to get this to follow the presentation. But then you put it all together for all your participants, and you end up with a square. You know, think a cube similarity matrix. And then what you do is you begin to map the data. So to map that data, the sum squared similarity matrix is represented as distances in Euclidean space. And so basically, you have the first statement, and your next statement is plotted in relation to how many people grouped the two statements together. So this is what it looks like. So there's one and two, and it's represented by distance to each other in terms of how often people rated them together. And you can also look at this as a coordinate matrix, and you can compute the distances between all of the points, and you can use our favorite formula, a squared plus b squared equals c squared. That's the only thing we all remember from geometry. And that can be shown as a distance among the points, and then you get a distance matrix. And you assess the stability of your model using a stress statistics, and it's the relationship between the similarity input matrix and the distances on the map. And so a low stress value means that there's greater correspondence between these two and that you have a really nice stable model. The cluster analysis then takes all of the points on the map and it begins to group them. And it groups them first small and the groups get bigger and bigger. And eventually you end up with a line around your entire set of points. Okay, so, our study sample, as I said, it's small, but the power in this is actually sort of the statistical method and the fact that it's really grounded, that the folks are offering you their specific suggestions and then telling you how they think about it. So it was evenly distributed by six, mostly Black and Latino, and most were born in the United States. I'm going to go right to the map. So this is our 13-cluster map solution. The stress statistic was acceptable at 0.23, and you can see that we have lots of different areas with the labels of some of them. I'm trying to find one, but I can't find it, but we'll look at number two is involving 911 or the police. Oh, number one is at the bottom, getting physically involved. So getting physically involved and engaging with the abuser, the items, the statements that were sorted together and then grouped together in the cluster analysis are close to each other. They're really far away, though, from cluster 8, which is parenting strategies. And those, so that means that people conceptualize them, as really different. We saw that these group in four general areas, community involvement, parenting, education, victim-focused, and perpetrator-focused. This is very consistent with our last study where we found similar results. These are some of the items as exemplars from the different domains. You can go back to the slide and look at them specifically if you want. I want to just talk about differences in terms of feasibility real quick because that's the meat of the presentation. So feasibility for self, we found that the lowest average feasibility was for strategies focused on the perpetrator and formal systems, and the highest were for those focused in terms of parenting and education. But none of them got much better than 3.5, which is in between moderately and very feasible. We found that if there was a history of IPV in the home, there was almost no difference, and there was difference in those ratings between feasibility generally and feasibility if there's IPV in the home, which was actually sort of surprising to me. But we did find that feasibility was rated significantly higher when there was a perception that children were in the home or were witnessing the abuse. So that was interesting. In terms of effectiveness, we saw again that the lowest rating was for perpetrator informal systems. The highest was for education and parenting. But again, none of them got to very effective. So this is a summary slide. We also looked at modifying factors in terms of sociodemographics. Women rated intervention as more feasible than men, and when the couple was perceived to have a history of IPV. People with a high school degree rated feasibility as lower than those who had only a GED or more. Participants not born in the U.S. rated general feasibility higher than U.S.-born participants, and there were no other differences by sociodemographic factors. Participants who reported ever being a victim or perpetrator rated feasibility lower than those reporting never being victimized, but that was not statistically significant. The difference in effectiveness, though, was statistically significant for victims versus non-victims, with non-victims perceiving all strategies as nearly very effective, whereas victims perceive them as only moderately. And this really fit into some of the comments that we heard during the groups, which was, you know, from women who self-identified as victims, they said, you know, you really only leave when you're ready to leave. None of this is going to help until the woman is ready to leave, whereas non-victims were a little bit more optimistic that some of the strategies could actually help end or prevent the violence. Participants who reported victimization also rated parent-focused strategies lower, as well as community-focused and perpetrator-focused as compared to non-victims. Okay, so those are just some of the summing up. And I should be done. I will quickly just go through this, if that's okay. So the big finding here is that participants rated feasibility to intervene significantly higher when they thought a child was involved. So this is consistent with Slater-Johanna Johnson's framework, where they basically say that neighbors may feel a greater responsibility to act, and that similarly norms of tolerance of IPV that underlie general unwillingness to act may be weakened when the victim is a child as well as a woman. This is a little bit different from what has been found or in a review of literature by Waltimore, which says that there's a very high tolerance of IPV, and that that tolerance is actually higher when a woman is considered to be a bad mother. So that was interesting. So in conclusion, there's a wide range of bystander behaviors out there, much wider than has been conceptualized and measured in the literature previously, especially for IPV. We need more research. We need to develop a scale. But we should note that none of these items ever reached extremely feasible or effective. So none of them are really perceived to be things that are, you know, actually going to do it. But I think that reflects a realistic assessment of intimate partner violence. Concept mapping is a great method for doing this kind of research, and it can be applied directly in media campaigns and programming. And an example of that is the Ring the Bell campaign. I don't know if any of you have seen that, but it's in India, and all you have to do is Google it, and you'll see it's a media campaign that encourages bystander intervention. And it could potentially be developed using true stories of people who did this. I just want to acknowledge the participants who helped us with this study. They're, of course, central to it, the funding. And I also just want to note my mentors on my K Award, which was a really long time ago. I'm still eking data out of it, but Dave Lahav, Pat Acampo, who were my primary mentors, and Christina Salmon actually taught us the method. And Concept Systems, Inc. provides the training for this. And I also have to say that they provided those fabulous slides that had all the maps. I never would have been, not the maps, but the circles and the matrices. I couldn't have done that myself, so thank you.
Goes off somewhere, so a woman with Right. And say, listen, I'm Sarah, I live in that third house over there. I live there. You should know that. And I just, you've got all those kids. I remember when, I didn't know my kids, but when they were young, I'm going to the store, can I get you something?
Right. Yeah.
And that's all.
Yep. And that's absolutely one of the ideas that people came up with. So for victim focused, it was, you know, a lot of referrals, but some of it was have a girls' day with friends, serve as a healthy couple example. A lot of them, though, were items like just let her know that you're there, let her know where you live, let her know that you have information that could help her, and then parenting education again was, I mean, that's actually not as focused on that. But those ideas definitely came up, and those are very low-risk activities that people can engage in. That can help. So you're absolutely right. And I think people think bystander intervention. They literally think, like, you hear the screaming and the things knock, and you knock on the door and you try to break it up. No, I mean, that's not the only option. There's a whole range of things that we can do that, right, and that came out very clearly, too, that no, and that's why they were rated as much less feasible, was that, you know, we're not doing that. But there's a whole range of options that can be done way before, and it's very much like what you were saying. You said you change it from beyond, but you're talking about before. Mm-hmm. You know, these are things that they're low risk activities that neighbors can engage in. So that's exactly right. Yeah.
Well, and I feel like opportunities like this, and I'm curious if this came up in your research, in communities that have a very poor experience generally with the police or with institutions, there's alternatives.
Yes, and what's really interesting here is that we conducted two studies in two different neighborhoods. The first study was conducted in neighborhoods that probably has less legal cynicism, and this study was conducted in a very high legal cynicism neighborhood. And we got significantly lower ratings on the police and criminal justice focused responses in this neighborhood than this neighborhood. I didn't present that here. It's very sort of local. It's in the paper, which is actually about to go out. I was waiting to, you know, get some feedback and, you know, thought I could integrate. But that was something we found, and that's absolutely right. And so in neighborhoods where, you know, people don't want to call 911 because it's just going to bring badness into the neighborhood or to the building, yeah.
They're taking care of the kids, and they're taking care of her. I mean, it's a strange way to do it, but it worked for them.
Well,
it's also been to me when people say, well, those people, we all just say, I've seen at least twice when they did a great job of taking care of everybody. Mm-hmm. No paperwork, no agency.
Right, right. And that's informal solutions, because you don't want to involve the formal system. They know it's only going to make it worse, so...
So I have to just disclose, and this is just really exciting. I just love you and what you just said, because, you know, you see me now with all the degrees and the pedigree, but I grew up in the housing projects, and my mom was an alcoholic, my dad was a crackhead, and I am a product of that informal system, and I never got into care because somebody would always come and get the children and let them go into the system. But I wanted to ask you this, though. One of the things that also worked is that, and the reason why our grandmother was called when all those things would happen, is because a neighbor asked, she actually said, I saw what happened. I know you have big brothers. Is there, next time he does that, is there somebody that I could call for you? How does that work? What does that do for what you know works? And so that way, my mom would give a number.
Yeah.
Is that a way to get around
that
police?
That was a strategy that was offered
that
as well.
Up.
That absolutely came up in our...
Strange story to tell about somebody. I don't know how that would work. they had block mothers, mm-hmm. didn't have block fathers. Mm-hmm. But it was, I mean, you think about it, it makes sense. And then the major problem is the big power structures, the gods, Congress, whatever, say it has to be an official thing. Mm-hmm.
Right, yeah, go ahead.
And on the converse, my question was, what excuse or explanations do people give where they saw things were not feasible? Was it the fear? Was it the police? What were the things they cited as any given interactions not that they did not perceive to be feasible?
Yeah, I mean, definitely the lower ratings for perpetrator focus was fear. And correct fear that there would be retaliation, that he would have a gun, he would have, you know. And so those were literally like, go in and break up the fight. So that's why they were rated lower. The comments that we got around not intervening more generally, but particularly in terms of victim perpetrator focus, was she never leaves anyway. It's never going to end. The victim is always, you know, has to make the decision. And we would have people tell these, you know, their own stories during these groups. But we did see that where, you know, we saw that victims rated all of these strategies as less feasible and effective. Non-victims rated them, they perceived that they would be more effective and more feasible. So it is a lot of what we suspected. We were really, yeah, well, it is, and again, these were some victims who were saying it, so it was their experience of it. We always, of course, just sat back and listened. But we definitely also, as I, you know, pointed out, we did not see a difference for a perception that there was violence in the home in terms of the ratings, which really was strange to us, so, yeah. Right, and yeah, and the way we said effective was, it's too far back, I'd have to, it's could prevent it now or in the future. It was broadly defined, but people, you know, no matter how many times you try to, in these groups, you try to orient them to your definitions and your questions and your way of thinking, you're like, no, don't think this, but think just like 2 inches this way. Mm-hmm. People don't think like that, you know, they're just like, it means the abuse stopped. It means that it ended and she never got hit again. So they're very concrete and the strategies in a lot of ways reflect that. So, yeah.
Was there any time where a participant
Yes, and that was definitely, yeah, it's definitely in the community action, in the community area, improving the community and social and natural environment and neighborhood involvement. There were items that, you know, involved get churches, schools, and community organizations to do workshops on domestic violence. Get in the, not this study, but I distinctly remember this item from the previous study, which was Brooklyn-based. There was items about get major faith leaders to speak out on IPV. And that's a well-known push that has been happening across the country to try, you know, to get to them to bring their considerable influence to the issues of HIV and intimate partner violence. So.